This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Listening to Joy 94.9, Brendan Bauer with you. I'm joined by the lovely David John Hunt sitting opposite.
Hello, Brendan Michael Bale.
Hello, and of course you are listening to Sunday Arts Magazine every Sunday at 4 p.m. For a little bit longer. We're having a bit of a break soon.
Well, I'm having 1 week off in 2 weeks' time, but you're having 5 weeks off because you're going to Europe, aren't you?
I certainly am, David.
And I need you to come back with lots and lots of stories about the wonderful art you've seen while you're
there. Yes, well, I might have to go see the statue of your namesake, I think.
David, yes, in Florence. Get there early. You'll have to queue for a few hours to do it. So, yeah, it's brilliant. It's all that art that's just there. So you're going to have a wonderful time. But we've got a show to get on with today. We've got to thank the guys from Three Chords and a Truth for yet another wonderful show. They played the twist, Chubby Checkers the Twist today, lovely to hear that.
I think you nearly pulled something earlier, didn't you?
I did, like twisting around the reception area.
Now, there's been some lovely messages in from the previous show, and we'd love to hear from you as well.
Yes.
You can do that on 0427 Joy 949, or you can grab us on our email, super easy, onair@joy.org.au.
Yep.
And you can check out our podcasts on joy.org.au as well. The lovely Julia has been keeping those up to date.
So she's doing a brilliant job, thank her every week because it's great that we've got the podcast up. And so if you missed the show today or you want to hear one of the interviews again, after about 2 or 3 days it will be up, or maybe it's about 4 days, it's up and you can listen to it at your leisure.
Catch up. We've had some great guests over the last
Have. Yes. So today's no exception.
Yes, and we're going to have a great interview later in the show with Ted Gott. He's back in the studio again. Mm-hmm. But we were lucky enough to go check out the exhibition he's going to be talking about.
We did. We saw it today on our way here. Yeah.
And it is called The Horse.
The Horse, yes.
Very fitting title because it is all about the majestic, the beautiful horse.
Mm.
I absolutely loved it, and I love that the fact that they... where I started the exhibition anyway, and I think you did as well, the mythology behind the horse.
Yes.
And from both Greek and Roman mythology. And I thought that was wonderful. Sort of sets it up from, way, way, way back.
And the beauty of a horse, and the fact is that was used saying the workhorse, which is so true, because that was the only means of pulling carts and pulling equipment, ploughing the fields, but also the beauty of the horse, because it is very majestic, isn't it, the horse? And why wouldn't people want to celebrate it through the ages in art?
And, talking about going through the ages, one of the standout pieces was from, I think it was 500 BC.
Mm.
And that just blew me away.
I know. It's incredible.
And the way everything's set up is quite wonderful as well.
Again, they do a wonderful job. So Ted will be in a little bit later to talk about that. Now, what have you been up to this week, Brendan?
Well, David, I've been quite busy. Man about town as I am. But I made the effort to go see the new Ori Kelly Dressing Hollywood exhibition yesterday morning.
Right.
Now, it was nice and quiet.
When it was nice and quiet. Now, you have seen the film by Gillian Armstrong?
I did, and I got to interview Gillian when it was released at the Astor. They had the gala opening
there.
That's
right, yep.
The reopening of the Astor, and we were lucky enough to have a chat with her that night and do a bit of video, but also see the film, and it really sets up the beautiful work that Ori Kelly was able to create during his career.
In Hollywood.
In Hollywood.
And he was an Australian.
He was an Australian.
And back in the 30s. Yeah, back in the 30s. I always find that just fascinating, the fact that an Australian ends up in Hollywood being one of the biggest costume designers for Hollywood at the time, when all the big musicals, that's what he did. So just fascinating that it was an Australian that did it.
I know. And, you know, he started off living in New York.
Yes.
And living with Cary Grant.
Before he was called Cary Grant. Yes.
And then Cary gave him his first sort of introduction, basically, to Jack Warner at Warner Brothers.
Yep.
Or Time Warner, I think it was called back then. And that was his start.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have lasted very long if he didn't have the talent, I'll put it that way.
Absolutely. And he was a very outwardly gay too, which is the other really interesting side of him. In an era where everyone was a bit very closeted, like Cary Grant, who married to, you know, the Hollywood heavyweights told him he had to marry, which I think he did two or three times over his life, because you couldn't be gay, outwardly gay. But this guy was, or he was very outwardly gay.
And he was lucky to have the confidant of Jack Warner's wife, which was wonderful, which kind of helped him. And but she relied on him so much as a friend and as a confidant as well.
Right.
So it was this sort of beautiful relationship up until his passing, unfortunately. But
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so tell us about the costumes.
Oh, well, the costumes, there's a nice sort of selection. And the ones that I sent through to you yesterday and put up on the Facebook page, one of them was from Lay Girls, which won him an Oscar.
Right.
But also there was one from the Dolly Sisters, which I hadn't even heard of, to be honest. But it was this beautiful dress with eyes all over it.
Yeah, stunning.
So iconic.
Yeah.
And just to see it in the flesh was just, wow.
The amount of work that would have gone into making those costumes back then, because the sewing machines wouldn't be like the sewing machines of today.
No.
And the sequences were the real little tiny sequences you had to sew on. Now you stick them on with glue. It's a very different world now, especially for costumes. You know, if you bought a sequin dress, it's probably sequins, although a lot of them still are stuck on now. So the time and effort that would have gone into those costumes back then, and there were sometimes 100 women in the one costume, the same costume.
Well, exactly. And you take Lay Girls, for example, and there was a number of different ones. Gold Diggers of 1937, I think it was. Either one. There's two different versions. But his version, they deliberately got actresses or dancers that looked very similar.
Right.
And they all wore the same outfit. So it was kind of this optical illusion when you had them all on stage doing these beautiful, you know, choreographed dances where they kind of looked like they were clones of each other.
Yep.
Which is wonderful. But what set Ori Kelly apart and, you know, why people sort of hunted him down and locked him in to making their costumes, especially Bette Davis, was that he created costumes for the actress. They weren't generic. He was inspired by the actress themselves. And they have this beautiful sketch. I'm sure it was Bette Davis. And he used her actual face on the sketches, which was unheard of back then. It was all about, you know, you create the dress and you find the actress, the dancer, performer to fit the dress. But he sort of flipped it and said, well, no, I'm designing for an individual.
Yep.
And it really did set him apart and allowed him to create some wonderful, iconic dresses.
Because it was before the days of the stylist and using stuff from the big designers. They weren't doing it. They were actually creating the dresses themselves in studio, weren't they?
They certainly were.
Yep.
And I was totally unaware of was that they would then market it. They would sell patterns of his dresses and make money off it that way.
Okay.
And, you know, you could dress like Bette Davis and all that kind of stuff and make your own dresses to look like that.
Yep.
And of course, they sort of do that these days, but more so they'll recreate the dresses.
Yes.
They were doing that as well back then, but less about more, patterns these days.
Yeah, where people used to make their own clothes back then.
Exactly.
And so therefore you could look like exactly like. But well, the same as, you know, before records came along, the vinyl came along, people used to buy sheet music and sit around the piano and sing the songs, the ones I'd be hearing on the radio, which would be sung live. The same with the costumes you're seeing on the big films. You buy the pattern and make it yourself.
Exactly. And so I obviously recommend people going along to see it. It's a free exhibition.
A free exhibition.
At Acme. Yep. But what they're also doing, they've always got a bit of a package going on there. They're also going to be playing Ori Kelly films, so films that feature his beautiful works. So The penultimate one is Woman, He's Undressed. So that's the documentary, and
yes,
I'm going to make you go along to that one. So that starts on the 5th of September. But then you've got films like Some Like It Hot.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a queer classic, I feel.
Oh, very much so. And one of the most famous Hollywood films.
Mm. Of course, Marilyn Monroe, just gorgeous and pregnant while she was filming, looking absolutely stunning. And there's one photo that's on show with her, slightly turned to the side. And well, you didn't see this in the film, but there's a love heart on her buttocks.
Right.
That was cut into it. But it was a little bit risque. They were going through the code back then, so they couldn't quite get away with that.
Right.
But, yeah, to see the sort of on-set photos and Tony Curtis as well was beautiful. So that's going to be showing from the 12th of September. You've got Lay Girls, which I mentioned before, he won the Oscar for that. I think he shared the Oscar with that one. Fashions of 1934. This one's really interesting. I really want to go see that, which I'll have to go when I get back, unfortunately. But then what I mentioned earlier, Gold Diggers of 1933. It was 1933. That's a beautiful, beautiful arrangements and choreography to go with the costumes.
Yep.
Just beautiful, beautiful combination.
Right. So you can actually buy tickets and go and see the film.
Yes, you go buy the tickets for the films.
For the films,
but they're
the
very
film
cheap,
show,
I think.
Yeah. And some of the snippets of the film are part of the exhibition, are they?
Well, there is a montage in the corner, so you can get to see. And it's beautiful to see all the costumes come together. You get to see a bit from Gypsy, featuring Natalie Wood, of course. Such a great outfit. And I don't know, she was so beautiful, but so skinny as well.
Yeah.
And that costume is on show.
Okay.
The beautiful sort of gold with black trim. Stunning. So you do get to see a bit of the films and also his acceptance speeches, which are very, very short from the Academy Awards, two of the Academy Awards
right.
he won.
Okay.
So I can't recommend it enough. Get along there.
Excellent.
And seeing an Aussie icon that, you know, has been hidden for all these years. So finally, with the help of Gillian Armstrong, his, you know, legacy has come to light, and hopefully people will continue to know what he created. He did close to 300 films doing the costume design. That's incredible.
Yep.
And the reason that he probably didn't get more accolades, well, it is the reason he didn't get more accolades, was the fact that they didn't recognise costume design up until sort of the late 50s. So it's a real shame. He probably would have had many, many more Oscars in that time because he was very prolific. He would do many, many per year. And even, you know, up until when he passed on, he was still creating. And, you know, it was almost like a royal wedding fit for a queen when he did pass away. So, you know, it shows what an impact he did have on Hollywood. So, yes, you are listening to Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine. David and Brendan with you. Take it through till 5 p.m.
Joy.
You are on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine. And that was a track, Anyone Who Ever Had a Heart, which has done really well lately in the charts.
Well, but it also originally was sung by Cilla Black.
Exactly.
Who has just passed
away. Very much of the moment as well. But that is the Melbourne Gay and Lesbian Chorus's version from a number of years ago.
Yep.
But they performed that at their 25th anniversary that I was lucky enough to go along to.
Yep, last Saturday night.
Yes, and it was wonderful. Unfortunately, we didn't run out of time to talk about it on Sunday's show because, as we do,
it's
we
always
have too much,
much
on.
Yes.
But I thought I'd play it this week because that's such a beautiful rendition of it.
And they're a great chorus. They really are. Now, we've got a couple of guests in the studio with us. Brendan?
We do. Now, of course, we love Arts House and everything that they do. And we're lucky enough to welcome Shian Alor, firstly, and also Dwayne Morrison as well. Thank you guys for coming in, having a chat. Now, I'll start with you, Dwayne. You are the composer for this new show. We'll talk about that very soon. But tell us a little bit about being a composer and how much effort it took to get to where you are now.
It's constant sort of working it out as you go along. For this particular piece, though, I've been working with the choreographer, Joe Lloyd, for about the last 10 years or more.
Oh, wow. So you've done lots of things together.
Most of the sound for her shows.
Oh, right.
And many others.
Right. Now, did you study music? Is that where your beginnings came from?
Yeah, I did at Melbourne, at the Con.
Right.
Very serious background for a less serious.
Right. And is this what you wanted to do? Did you want to do music? Is this all you do, or is there other stuff you do as well?
It's pretty much all I do particularly well. Put all my eggs in one musical basket, really. So
right. And because dance these days relies heavily on the music, of course it does, that's what it's all about. And it's the collaboration, like you obviously have with Joe, is so important, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, totally. It's a very natural kind of thing with Joe and I. Obviously, every project's different, but with her and I, it's very...
And as how contemporary or avant-garde is this piece of music?
Pretty with the times. It's being made in sort of real time from modular blocks, a sort of electronic score, piano based,
right,
in response to the dance. So it's, I think, in its flexibility, it's pretty modern.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you work it through with her? Does she come to you with the concept, of course, but then do you sit in with her while she's dreaming the movements up? Or does she have it set in her mind, or do you write the music and then she goes off and does a choreographs around the music?
All of the above.
Right.
Depending on the moment. Sometimes it's in there, sometimes it's in response to video, sometimes I hope it all fits together. Magical moments.
Right. So. And how rewarding must it be for you, sort of sitting there in the audience once it's opening night, hearing the music with everyone awash with hearing the music and the performers on stage doing their bit?
It is that. It's a bit of an ego trip. When it's loud and it's moving people's bodies with sub bass and things, I like it.
You like it?
I do.
So, Shian, tell us a bit of your history. You're a performer, dancer. When did you start?
I'm studying at VCA, Bachelor of Dance, for 3 years. And after that, and Joe is the first choreographer that I work with. I went to her class and she asked me to come in for an audition, and I work with her since. It's been about 5 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
you work exclusively with her, or?
No, not exactly. That was the first dance sort of professional engagement that I have. And then since then, I make my own work and I collaborate with many different type of artists. Live art, interdisciplinary sort of practice. So I do a wide range of stuff.
Right. How hard is it for a dancer to exist in this climate?
It's tough, but at the moment I can actually work professionally as a dancer, which is like, it's not completely hopeless, but it takes a while to sort of build up.
Yep.
You know, it requires a sort of like really good network and plan ahead and sort of have a really good business mindset to sort of project into the future.
And the collaboration that you mentioned before, is that part of, I guess, the survival mechanism as well, you know, making those connections with other creative people?
Yeah, like cross-pollination is a very important strategy. Diversification of practice, like I don't just work in dance. I work with, I worked with app developer before to create performances. I worked with a lot of musicians and filmmakers.
Right. So in terms of the new media, you just discussed the app. Like, what other sort of mediums are you sort of hoping to work in, and how are you influenced by new media?
I didn't invent this, but I kind of have this sort of like post-medium practice, like as a dancer or a choreographer. I'm actually making a documentary at the moment, looking at, you know, dance. So using different sort of medium to sort of reinvestigate what I do. So I think that's my interest at the moment.
And do you work with, I guess, narrative a lot, or is it more of a, I guess, a postmodern lack of narrative in your work?
It's
a mixture.
It's a mixture. So I think it's from project to project, but in my work, it tends to be quite philosophical. It's more about answering some kind of philosophical question I have for myself.
With Dwayne sitting next to you, how important is the music to you in a production like this? Is it crap what he does, or is it wonderful what he
Careful.
Does?
I work with Dwayne as well. So, like, Joe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Joe, yep. Dwayne, and I, we've been working for a while together.
Yep.
So, like, the report is really there. And, you know, sometimes we speak in codes that nobody can understand, which is quite fascinating. It's really, particularly for this project, it's really interesting because neither is the driver for what is unfolding. Of course, the movement has its own thing, but the music has another different layer of imagination to it. So it doesn't necessarily, so which, you know, it's not in a very conventional sort of
And does it keep evolving even after the first performance? Is it sort of its own creature that keeps evolving?
Yes.
Through each
this one more than any other. Yeah, it's
so you've got the freedom to divert a little bit from the what's been, you know, how you've been taught to dance the piece.
It is quite a new experience for Joe, I, and Rebecca Jensen, another dancer. We worked together for 5 years.
Yep.
So there's no some kind of scripted movement.
Right, okay.
In this. There's some kind of physical parameters, some kind of approach to what we do, but we don't exactly know what will happen. Mm. And structurally, throughout the whole piece, like, we are constantly in a kind of state of confusion that we don't know what is to be unfold.
Right. Dwayne, tell us, what is this piece about?
It's generally, the way I read it, it's about letting go of or recognising habits and diverting from them in every kind of choice that gets made.
What's it
in
called?
Performance. Confusion for three.
Well, so is there confusion within the three people on where they're going, what they're doing? What's the confusion?
I can only speak for myself. It's my own confusion. But generally, I think it's about the internal lack of... confusion is a word that Joe has chosen. But I think it represents a lack of
it's about
clear
the
path.
Unknown. Mm. I think it's really about the unknown. So I can decide, three of us standing there looking into the space, and then in that moment we have to decide what is to happen, but we don't make a clear decision. We just run into it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously we know something about each other. We know we have rehearsed for 2 years, but each time as we approach the moment, we don't know. You know, we have like different sort of performance, sort of like practice to keep ourselves in that state. Like, we don't know. We're constantly gauging, trying to form it. Each moment is some kind of epiphany. But once we understand it, we have to let that go and go into the next moment.
Right. So sounds fascinating. It's on an arts house in North Melbourne. The wonderful people, as Brendan was saying earlier. When does it open?
Coming Wednesday. It's right. Sold out, so you have to start booking.
Right, so yeah. So opening night is sold out. And how long's it on for?
A week, Wednesday to Sunday.
Right.
There are two shows on Saturday.
And you just go to the Arts House website to book tickets.
Yes.
Right. Thank you so much for coming in. And it's so adventurous and so wonderful what you guys are doing. And I take my hat off to you. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy. You're on John 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine. David and Brendan with you. I'm Brendan.
I'm David.
And we're gonna sneak in another little interview this afternoon.
Yep.
We've got a couple of people from Orchestra Galasso Bashaldi, if I'm saying that correctly.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
It is.
So tell us a little bit about the orchestra and what's happening. What do we need to know?
Well, the orchestra is a community-based orchestra, and we're based in Northcote. We play world music, so we play lots of different tunes from around the Mediterranean all up through Croatia, Bulgaria.
So folk music.
Anyways. Yeah, folky type music.
Yeah.
And last year we ran a very successful composition competition, and we're running it again this year, which is part of the Darabin Music Feast. And it's open to anyone in Victoria who is either a composer or an aspiring composer who may have a little tune tucked away in their back drawer that they feel inspired to pull out so that we can play. And we're really, really keen to do this. Competition closes on the 30th of August.
Yep.
Details are obtainable from our Facebook page, Orchestra Galasso Bashaldi. And we're actually performing the pieces that win on the 1st of November at a big concert in the Northcote Town Hall.
Right. Now, next to you, we're last year's winner.
Yes, indeed. Omid Cheyenne, who is the inaugural winner of the competition from last year.
So how did you find out about this, or were you involved in the orchestra beforehand?
No, I was just kicking around Melbourne, and someone handed me a flyer and said, why don't you do this? And I'm like, oh, I can't win that. And he said, yeah, give it a go. And I did. And here we are.
And what sort of music did you compose? What was the piece?
It was you played it, didn't you?
We did.
It's a brassy Middle Eastern kind of
very very
vibe.
Brassy.
Yeah, a bit of fun, something kind of a bit more up tempo, and yeah, a bit more sort of interactive, I think.
Yeah, it was lots of fun to play, and that's really one of the things that is most important to us when we're performing, is that we've got music that is fun to play and people are likely to want to jump up and dance to.
Right, okay. And what is that? What has it done, having that piece of music played by an orchestra and performed and with an audience? Is that important for you as a composer?
Extremely important, because if I can speak for all other musicians around, it's kind of very rare that someone can write a piece and actually have an orchestra play it. It gets very, very tiring hearing your songs being played on a computer by MIDI instruments all the time.
Yeah.
So to actually have a group of people quite passionately playing it and workshopping it. There's one session where they came and they said, you know, what do you think about this? We're playing it this way. And it's rare for a Melbourne musician to get a chance to really have people workshop your piece and talk about it and then perform it. It's really a thrill.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
And Marcy, is that general practice each year, sort of that collaborative process to get the composer and the orchestra happy?
Absolutely. And that'll be happening again this year, the second year that we're running this. And it's really exciting for the orchestra, and I play in that orchestra, I play clarinet, to actually have the opportunity to meet with the composers and workshop the music with them.
How many people are in the orchestra?
It ranges between 20 and 30, depending on how people feel on any given weeknight.
Yeah.
But that's what we did last year, was we invited a whole lot of people who have played with the orchestra before to come back as guest stars and perform with us. So we had probably about 35 people.
Right.
I should add in here, but you don't have to write 35 charts.
No, you don't.
Yeah, it's
the one piece of music.
And yeah, it's five or six parts. Yep. And it's nice and democratic and not too... You don't have to be an MSO member have a go. I'm not.
Excellent. So it's a Facebook that you go to find out the details.
Yep.
If you're a composer out there and you'd like to have a go at it, what is it
again?
Or
you can go to the Darabin Music Feast site, which is a well-known music event that happens in Northcote.
Yep.
And there'll be details of the competition on that site too.
And what's the orchestra called again on the Facebook page?
It's called Orchestra with a Z.
Yep.
Glasso, GLASSO, Bashaldi, BASHALDE.
Thank you.
Told the prizes at all?
The total prize pool is $3,000.
Oh, wow.
So it's a big whacking prize for an aspiring composition.
Absolutely. And also to get the piece played in front of an audience.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in, guys.
No thank
worries.
You.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
The very talented Chelsea Wilson here on Joy 94.9. That is, I hope you'll be very unhappy without me.
Melbourne's very own. And she's doing such big business. She's working so hard and it's really paying off. I think she's a great talent. So congratulations, Chelsea.
And that's our little shout out to all those horrible exes out there. Now, from unhappiness to very, very happy situations.
And we spoke about it at the head of the show that we went to the exhibition today.
Yes, we did horse around at the start of the show a little bit. This is the first of many horse puns coming. We are really happy to welcome back Ted Gott from the NGV.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Ted, for sparing a bit of time on your Sunday again.
Oh, pleasure. It's great to be back with you.
I'm sure you're a very, very busy man at the moment, but we're going to talk about all about the horse. As David mentioned, we did see it this morning and had a good look around. But tell us a little bit about the exhibition and how it came about.
Well, the horse came about because we wanted to do a show that celebrated the strength of the NGV's collections. So first of all, we looked for a theme and we went through a number of themes, and then the animal-related kingdom came to mind, and suddenly we seized upon the horse. My co-curator, Laurie Benson, has been passionate about horses all his life, and in fact, his mother, Margaret Benson, wrote the biography of Tommy Woodcock, Farlap Strapper, in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
Laurie comes from horstocracy, as it were. So it was a perfect fit for him. And I had done a gorilla show years ago, so I love doing animal-related shows. So then we decided to look at what was actually in the collection. So the first task was to muck out the stables, as it were. And the NGV's got 62,000 works, and we trawled right through them with the help of our colleagues in every curatorial department. And we eventually found 1,000 horses. We stopped counting there.
Gosh.
So that's incredible. There's doubtless more. Laurie thinks 1,500. So one in 60 works in the entire collection is devoted to the horse.
Why do you think it is? I have my thoughts on it, but it would be nice to hear your thoughts. Why is there so much about horses in the collection?
Well, we then started looking at the history of the horse in art, and right from the very first cave paintings in prehistoric times in France, the very first marks that humanity makes on the walls are images of horses. So it's clear that the horse has been symbiotically linked to humanity since the dawn of time.
And of course, back hundreds, thousands of years ago, it was a form of transport.
Absolutely.
The workhorse, as we know that term, where it was really important, ploughing, which is a beautiful painting. It's a photograph of the guy ploughing. You just see his back with the horse in the distance. And battle, of course, which so many horses must... There's a couple of them where I had to walk away because you just see the horses would probably be... Or it would be terrifying for the horse to be in that sort of situation. But it played a major part. But then, as a beautiful beast, must be so exciting for artists to actually paint, or some of the sculptures of them that you had there were just wonderful because it is a beautiful beast, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's why we have one section of the show that's just called Spirit, which is about artists celebrating just the majesty, beauty and power and mythical quality of the horse. And we think that perhaps stems from just the fact that when you are mounted on a horse and riding free, you get this incredible sense of being flying across the earth and feeling almost superhuman yourself, liberated by the energy of the horse. And perhaps that's why so many legends have developed around the horse. And that led us to decide to do the exhibition not chronologically and not by civilization or country of origin of the works, but by thematic groupings, which I think works quite well.
Yeah. And you covered, like, there are just so many powerful. When you first walk into the exhibition, there's a huge piece with horses in the sea.
Yes, Lucy Kent Welch.
Stunning.
Wonderful work shown at the Royal Academy in London in 1900.
Yep.
Great painting. Lucy Kent Welch devoted her entire career to painting horses, and she's best known today really for her 1915 illustrations to Anna Sewell's great horse novel Black Beauty.
Ah.
So that's the Lucy Kent Welch that everyone knows, but no one knows her name,
as
it were. We've all grown up looking at her illustrations for Black Beauty.
Yeah. So it goes back over the centuries, the paintings or sculptures or plates or little bits and pieces. What's the most recent piece?
The most recent piece is a beautiful drawing done just in March of this year by Melbourne artist Marley Moyer.
Love it.
It's called Queen of Hearts. Mm. It's charcoal on canvas, and it's a life-size portrait of an eight-week-old foal. It's absolutely exquisite.
With a little heart.
A heart-shaped white spot on the forehead. And then
stunning.
We invited Marley to collaborate with us and to do a series of horse rump doorways in the second half of the show, which sounds really strange to say on radio, but they actually work beautifully and they tie the whole show together. These life-size rear ends of horses. We've got a hunting horse and a dressage horse, a racing horse, and a war horse, and they just tie the themes of the show together beautifully. The great thing about this show, it's enabled us to put together 262 works drawing from every single department in the National Gallery's collection. So we've got painting, sculpture, international art, Australian art, Chinese art, Indian art, Japanese art, fashion and textiles, prints and drawings, photography, indigenous art, you name it, it's in the exhibition. And by going thematically, we've been able to mash up historical periods and different cultures. And so we take the same story and you put together a Chinese work, a Japanese work, an ancient Greek vase, a Renaissance bronze and a Rajasthani miniature from India, and you've got something quite spectacular going on.
There's one piece, it goes an entire wall that you have to look down, and it's a funeral.
Yes, that's one of the pieces that actually led to the decision to do the exhibition. Laurie and I have wanted to display that work for the last 14 years.
Wow.
Now, the work in question
is
very special. It's never been displayed.
Wow.
It's a concertina print, so it collapses down into just quite a small shoebox-shaped a book.
Almost like a postcard size each frame, isn't
That's
it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And it was published in 1853, and it is a 20-metre long etching and aquatint that's hand watercoloured, and it shows the funeral procession of Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington, at the end of 1852 in London. Still the largest and most lavish funeral procession ever held in Great Britain. And it looks enormous, but incredibly, we're only able to show 14 and a half metres of it. So we do apologise for the missing 5.5 metres.
Bastards, how dare you not show it all?
But our gallery was only 14 and a half metres wide, and our budget did not extend to breaking through the walls. But it's a spectacular work of art, and it shows every regiment of both cavalry and infantry, every dignitary's carriage that was at the funeral procession, and it ends with a spectacular catafalque with the coffin of the Duke of Wellington, and then his single horse, his riderless horse with the boots hanging backwards.
Yes. And I love the actual coffin. It's a bit bigger. It folds out.
Yes.
It folds up.
It's a double page that folds up.
Yes.
It's a sort of an explosion of grief, as it were.
Yeah.
Because it's not a happy work, but it's spectacular.
No, but it is very spectacular. There's a Ned Kelly.
A wonderful Ned Kelly by Sidney Nolan. We had to have the most famous horse in Victorian mythology. Or not mythology, but, you know, legend.
Yes.
So Ned Kelly on
his horse had to be in there. Well, a lot of it was sort of made up along the way, wasn't it?
There are lots of works that are celebratory and joyful. There is a very sad room, however, as you referred to, looking at the abuse of horses by humanity in conflict.
Mm.
And that serves to remind us that, for example, the Battle of Waterloo, 18th of June, 1815, which the Duke of Wellington won, defeating Napoleon.
That's a spectacular painting.
Yes, it is a spectacular painting. Yeah. 1875, showing a scene from the Battle of Waterloo by Lady Butler. But on that day, there were 80,000 horses on the field of combat, at Waterloo in southern Belgium, and 10,000 of the horses died on that day.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, another statistic that's really important to remember is that we sent 145,000 Waler horses, named after New South Wales, to World War One, and only one came back.
Oh, gosh,
So the cost to the horse of our greed and our desires for conquest have been enormous.
Yes.
The horse has also brought us wonderful pleasure.
Yep.
And it's been a means of transport ever since wedding and funeral processions in ancient Greece, ancient Egypt. It's been used in competitive sports from ancient Egypt through ancient Greece and Rome in chariot races. And that continues today, of course, in the celebratory room that ends the show, the room called Pleasure, which looks at horse racing and merry-go-rounds and circuses. Horses of our youth that brought us pleasure, and also ends with the Melbourne Cup, of course.
Yes. Now, there is even a Melbourne Cup there. It's 1980, is it?
It's 1980, but it's actually the holy grail of Melbourne Cups, because it is the 1930 Melbourne Cup won by Farlap.
Ah.
And Melbourne Cup historian Andrew Lemon has reconstructed its history.
Yep.
When the owner of Farlap went bankrupt, he had to sell everything. He sold the cup back to the Victoria Racing Club. It's a solid gold cup. So it's not, you know, a mere trinket.
Mm.
In 1953, obviously when they didn't have enough money to mint a new cup, the Victoria Racing Club scrubbed out Farlap's name in 1930 reissued it as a 1953 Melbourne Cup.
Yeah.
That was later on sold once again to the VRC. And then in 1980, the same thing happened and the 53 winner was scrubbed off and it was presented as the 1980 Melbourne Cup.
Gosh.
But it's actually Farlap's Cup, which is great.
Okay. And there's a little screen, the only moving visual is Farlap winning the Melbourne Cup.
Farlap winning the Melbourne Cup, but also what's even more important than Farlap winning the Melbourne Cup in that video is the fashions at the
Cup. Yes. Now, on that point, the one that I pointed out to Brendan, I said, you've got to look at this. It's the betting ring at the Melbourne Cup. It's huge, and the detail is quite spectacular.
It is. It's by an Austrian artist, Karl Kahler, who came to Australia in the 1860s.
As a portrait painter. Yeah.
Thank you. And he decided to do great group portraits of people enjoying the Melbourne Cup. And the Victoria Racing Club has a whole group of them, and they've loaned us this one, the betting ring, for our horse exhibition. And it's just spectacular. It has portraits of hundreds of people. They're all real portraits.
Yes.
And people paid Carla to be in the painting.
Did they?
So we know who everyone is.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And so we haven't put that in the exhibition because it's too much information.
Yes.
But at the Victoria Racing Club where they live in the members' room, they do have dioramas that identify every single person in the painting, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Look, I can just tell the way you're talking how much pleasure you've had in putting this exhibition together.
Look, it's been the best ride of our life, really.
As it were. Boom, boom. Boom, boom.
We couldn't wait to saddle up.
Well, someone else who's trotted over and checked it out is the lovely Eric.
Oh, hello.
He says some niceties, but we'll leave that out. But he just wanted to say that he has seen the horse exhibition 3 times now, and he's amazed that, you know, bar a few of the works from the VRC, that it is all from the NGV collection. Indeed. And a lot of things that he hasn't ever seen before.
Yes, what a wonderful punter.
Incredible,
thank you,
Eric. Yes.
Yes, we did bring a lot of things out of the woodwork that haven't been seen for a very long time, simply because, like the funeral procession of the Duke of Wellington, how can you ever display such a thing?
Yes.
So, you know, to construct a 14.5-metre long LED lit display box for that is quite costly, and you would only do it in this sort of theme show. So there are many works that have come together because of the theme that you often wouldn't have an opportunity to put out in other shows. So it's great, and it celebrates the riches of our collection, which is extraordinary.
Look, congratulations, absolutely spectacular. And the other thing that we really noticed while we were there is how many people were at the NGV today. Of course, you've got the big exhibition on at present, which you were in the other week talking about. It's wonderful, but people are just there, aren't they?
Yes,
everywhere is busy. And the horse, lots of people were looking at the horse.
Since the horse is open, people have been jockeying to get
here. Oh, hey. Ted, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you in.
Likewise, thank you.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy!
Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine with Brendan Michael Bale and David John Hunt.
That's me.
Now, films. Of course, you've been to a film this week.
Of course, of course. Well, I actually was lucky enough to go to head along to the Israeli Film Festival launch.
Yes.
At Cinema Como in South Yarra. So I was very, very lucky to actually get to see the opening night film, Matty Caspi Confession.
Right.
Now, this one's a little bit of an interesting one because it is
it's
a documentary about Matty Caspi, and I had no idea who that was.
No.
But to Israeli audiences, they assume they would know who this is. But it was an interesting documentary about I guess tradition, about the evolution of the Orthodox Church there, and how things sort of have kind of changed but not, and going back into his life. And luckily they actually got the clearance to have the film because there was some controversy around it, let's just say.
What, he tried to stop it?
Yeah, because he was interviewed, you know, very candidly within the documentary, and then he, you know, had a bit of regret, I think, of how open and honest he was.
And he didn't come across as the person he thought he would have come across in the doc.
I think so, and from my point of view, he wasn't that much of a likeable character at all. But, it'd be interesting to have a similar documentary about maybe an Australian star and find out their true story and, you know, peel back the curtain. So I think for Israeli audiences, that would be really, really interesting to watch. Mm. So, but I still had a fabulous time and always great. So that is on for another week or so in Melbourne.
Okay.
It is doing the rounds around Australia. So
yes. That's
till the 30th.
And that's the wonderful thing about the film festivals. They tour every state now, which is fantastic.
Certainly is. Well, that's it.
Well, that's it, Brendan. Yes, we've got to go. So thank you, everyone, for listening and enjoy this beautiful weather we've got.
Yeah, stick around for yesterday once more with Robert flying solo today. And also stick around for Marnie Banger with the news.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.